Hey, it's Andy Benoit.
And Gary Gramling from the MMQB 10 Things podcast. And we come to you with good news. We're now doing two shows every week.
That's right. Along with our Monday show, we'll now be in your feed on Thursdays with a 10 Things NFL Look Ahead podcast, as always, powered by the MMQB.com and Sports Illustrated.
So if you haven't already, please subscribe via iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Week 12 was full of wild endings. A bank shot wins it for the Chiefs in Denver. Good times in Tampa as the Bucks hammer Seattle. Derek Carr loses a finger but gains a win. And we even sneak in some Grey Cup talk. All that and much more on the MMQB 10 Things podcast. I want to tell you about our friends at Mack Weldon, because of the clothes they make, I'm wearing some of their sweats at the moment, and I don't mean to brag, but I can promise you, Mack Weldon is better than whatever you are wearing right now. They believe in smart design, premium fabrics, and simple shopping. I mean, it could not be easier. You got the holidays coming up. Tell your parents, tell your grandparents. Do your holiday shopping at Mack Weldon. Everything you need right there. It's that easy for anyone. And like I said, the stuff I have on looks great and it feels great. Mack Weldon has the most comfortable underwear, socks, undershirts, hoodies, and sweatpants that you will ever wear. All of their products are naturally antimicrobial, which means they eliminate odor. You'll look good. You can wear it all day. Wear it to the gym. Wear it on a date. You'll smell good. What else could you possibly want? I'll tell you what, Mack Weldon wants you to be comfortable, so if you don't like your first pair, you can keep it and they will still refund you, no questions asked. So go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off using the promo code MMQB.
The MMQB presents the MMQB 10 Things podcast, powered by digital media. Find your voice. And now, your hosts, Andy Benoit and Gary Gramling.
Hello and welcome to the MMQB 10 Things podcast. I am Gary Gramling. I am here with Andy Benoit. Hopefully you did not turn off the games after 1 o'clock today. The late window and the Sunday night games, ton of excitement. Andy, should we just jump into this whole thing?
Absolutely.
Number one.
All right, let's start with the Sunday nighter. It went late. Another one runs late. This is the Chiefs and the Broncos. KC comes out on top. If I had to describe this game in the most cliched metaphor possible, I would call it a street fight. This was an ugly defensive battle. Andy, what did you see out of this one?
Well, it's got to be the highest scoring ugly defensive battle in the history of the NFL, doesn't it? Because that's what it was. It was a street fight, and it was a 30-27 street fight. So there was also a chess match element within it, not just from Kubiak and Andy Reid, who are two of the better in-game chess players in the league, but also individual matchups across the board. There was a lot of man coverage, at least on Kansas City's side, and Denver's receivers get more comfortable with that. They get a feel for that. A lot of pass rushing battles that, in this case, favored the defense tremendously, but we saw those evolve over the course of the game. Both offensive lines got better in protection. It was a really good football game. I'm almost disappointed I saw this one live and not on film, because I'm sure there were a lot of nuanced adjustments in the secondary just based on the way these teams were playing, and a lot of them were doing coverage-based concepts. Blitzes were a factor, but not a huge factor in this game.
Yeah, and look, this one went all the way down to the wire in OT, in case you missed it. It was won on a Cairo Santos bank shot at the end of overtime. Both teams had kicked field goals previous to that. And I wonder how much the elevation played into the defensive performance in the second half. I mean, that's going to slow down your pass rush when it's all said and done. That Trevor Siemian, that really nice touchdown, he connected with Jordan Taylor to get the Broncos the early lead. I shouldn't say early. It was relatively early. It was early in the third quarter. That was a play where Houston, he chased Siemian across the, basically across to the opposite sideline, and it looked like he just sort of ran out of gas at the end of that. Siemian peeled back, and that's how the play happened. But, Siemian made a couple of plays like that tonight.
Yeah, you could say that play, the one that the Taylor 8-yard touchdown, was really a microcosm of what went well for both of these teams. You had Justin Houston getting tremendous pressure off the snap, almost made the sack. He made a number of plays. He didn't make that one, but he wrecked the play by getting pressure, and then Simeon made the play late anyway by using his legs, which is something he did a number of times in this game. Not a scrambler per se, but extending the plays. He was very good throwing on the move and outside the pocket, and that hasn't always been the case with him this season. So it was a good step forward for Simeon in a losing effort, unfortunately. The other thing, Gary, that I thought was very interesting was the way Kansas City used Travis Kelce in this game, and watching him on film last week against Tampa Bay and then seeing what he did. He beat Aqib Talib in overtime as an ex-ISO receiver, and he played ex-ISO receiver a lot, meaning he was on the weak side by himself and all three other eligible receivers were lined up on the other side of the formation. It's Kansas City's favorite formation. A lot of teams do it with their star tight ends, but what's different with Kelce is this season he has consistently beaten high-level corner backs when he's drawn those matchups as well. Yeah. There's nobody in the league right now who can cover him one-on-one.
Yeah. Yeah, and look, they got Tyreek Hill going a little bit tonight too, the speedster who's been more of a gadget type of guy and a return specialist. And, you know, they pulled out the win without Jeremy Maclin tonight. And, you know, for an offense that just hasn't been playing very well, it was a pretty big deal to get the back-to-back. They got the safety midway through the second quarter, and then off of the punt off of that safety, they got Tyreek Hill returning that for a touchdown, and that sort of got things going, and obviously they had just enough to hang on in the end. But this was a good one. This was a fun one.
Oh, it was a great one. Yeah.
And I was talking with Matt Evie, our producer, before the show. We were watching the end of this game together, and this was almost my fantasy coming true, because I was hoping the Broncos at the end of overtime were going to try that long field goal and miss it, and then the Chiefs would have like 4 seconds left, and they'd come back and do the exact same thing. You'd get back-to-back field goal attempts by each team in the elevation, because if the Chiefs had tried one right after that, it would have been a 65-yarder, which is a legitimate last-second attempt in Denver.
Yeah. Well, they, you know what they did? They went, and I hate to take your fantasy and then nerd it up with football stuff, but they went to their three tight end package, and I was surprised they didn't use that more in the game, because two things about Kansas City's three tight end package. One, they're very flexible out of it, because Demetrius Harris has wide receiver type elements. We saw him beat Chris Harris on the post up for the 2-point conversion. And then Kelce, of course, we just talked about him. So they're very flexible out of it. They can line up and spread out of three tight ends. And then Denver does not match up well to those packages. Atlanta beat them with similar stuff. San Diego, the heavier your personnel package is, the more complicated things become for Denver, because they don't like their linebackers in coverage. So anyway, they went to overtime in three tight end package, and they made that magical 65-yard field goal of yours into a more reasonable 30-yarder.
That wasn't as exciting. Back-to-back field. Could you imagine how exciting that would be, Andy, though? Back-to-back field goals by opposing teams?
Sure. But, hey, look, we got this one hit the pipe and went in, so you still got the oh, wow factor in it.
That was. It was a wonderful night for special teams.
Number two.
But with that, we will move on to topic number two. And this is Tampa kind of having their way with the Seahawks at home today. And I don't know, it feels like it's sort of past time to start taking the Bucs seriously in the NFC South.
Well, their defense has played very well the last 3 weeks, and they're doing a good job in really their basic cover three stuff. That is their foundation. And they're a vanilla zone defense a lot of the time. They'll mix in some stuff. They're not like they were under Lovie Smith, where they are like almost a tasteless vanilla even. But they're a very basic, straightforward defense, and they're executing well on the back end. But the guy that's really stood out, and he stood out early in this game, just like he stood out early last week, is Jameis Winston. And what they're doing to help him is giving chip block help and pass protection. So Damar Dotson at right tackle, Donovan Smith at left tackle, those guys were badly exposed by the Bears pass rushers back in week 10. That was a blowout win for the Bucs, but the Bears' defense really, even though it was 36-10 Buccaneers, the Bears' defense dominated that game at times.
Yeah.
So the Bucs have since then, they've started helping those tackles, and Winston looks a lot more comfortable now because, Gary, when you help your offensive tackles, not only do you get a better pocket, but you give the quarterback reason to expect a better pocket because he knows we've got seven guys blocking it initially in the down. So the quarterback can play freer and more comfortable throughout the play, and I think that's what Winston's been doing.
Yeah, I mean, he was only hit three times today, and that was on 28 dropbacks here. So,
yep, and that's against a good Seahawks pass rush. Still,
what do you think of the Seahawks defense right now? They're banged up. No Earl Thomas today, if I remember correctly. But
yep, he was out. Stephen Terrell played all right from what we could see in his stead. But Earl Thomas is a difference maker, of course,
and
not just because he's so good in center field, but he's become important in some of their man coverage concepts this season too. So yeah, you lose him. You don't have Deshaun Shedd in the lineup, which hurts your run support on the edge a little bit. And he's also obviously your starting cornerback. And then Michael Bennett being out, we've talked about how significant that is. And Kevin Coyle was also out. So a starter at all levels of the defense this week. And probably their two best players, really, are Michael Bennett and Earl Thomas.
And how about this, Russell Wilson got knocked around a little bit today. They did not really get it going at all. Is this a problem with the offensive line again? Or is this just getting basically out-executed by a rapidly improving Bucs secondary?
Well, I think the Bucs did a good job in the underneath levels out of zone coverage. So Lavonte David, Quan Alexander, Alteron Verner was playing along with Hargreaves under there, and the slot was Hargreaves. So it was a good performance by those shallow zone defenders. And the offensive line is going to get blamed for the loss because it's Seattle. We know their offensive line is not very talented, and they had a number of backups in there this game. And they gave up six sacks. But a lot of those sacks, Gary, came on situations where Russell Wilson had to pull the ball down or felt that he had to pull the ball down, including some three-step dropbacks. And if you're pulling the ball down on three-step dropbacks, you're going to get sacked more often than not because the offensive linemen are blocking under the assumption that the ball's coming out. So they're blocking differently than they would otherwise, and guys get beat that way. So it was a bad offensive performance, in fact. I think they had 1 yard passing net in the first half, and the game pretty much stayed that way. So yeah, it was good defense, bad offense. Anytime the stats are that skewed.
Yeah. Well, the Seahawks dropped to 7-3, but still plenty of margin for error in that NFC West. Things getting interesting in the South here. You got the Falcons sitting at 7-4. Bucks are right there at 6-5. Unfortunately, the teams have already had their two matchups this year, but you know, Bucks, they only have one loss in the division to the Falcons. Falcons lost to the Bucks, and This could be an interesting stretch run.
Well,
in a division that just hasn't been very interesting in recent years.
No, it hasn't. The Bucs also have the Saints left, and the Saints won today, and they're 5-6. So that doesn't sound like a great record, but when you factor in that they have two games against the Bucs, the Saints are basically in the same position the Buccaneers are in. So it's a tight race there in the NFC South.
Yeah, and the Panthers not really factoring into it much at all, and we will talk about that right now in topic number three.
Number three.
This was Carolina heading out to Oakland with a very depleted lineup, and this game was completely wild and wacky. The Raiders end up hanging on in the end. The guy we want to talk about from this game, we'll start with the good and then we'll get to the weird and then we'll get to the ugly, but we'll start with the good, and that is Khalil Mack. He really just had a monster game. He had a pick six at one point where he just a tremendous play where he read Panthers had faked a screen to the left and came back to the right, and Mack was right there waiting for it, got an easy pick six out of it. This game ended on his strip sack. He is obviously coming on of late. Not that he was not playing well early in the year, but I think he was kind of overshadowed by the fact that the Raiders just weren't stopping teams. But do you, everything kind of opens up with no J.J. Watt this season. Do you put Mack in that defensive player of the year conversation?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, he's absolutely in the conversation because for all the plays he does make, there's a number of plays that he's not making, but he's influencing the action still because he's a guy you game plan around. So without question, you put Khalil Mack in the conversation. I don't know if I'd give it to him. I think I'd have Von Miller probably a step ahead of him. And I don't know, maybe even though he's only played two games after tonight, maybe Justin Houston, heck, he's had a tremendous, I'm not going to give it to him, but there's a number of good edge rushers in the league right now, and Mack is at the forefront of that list.
Yeah. Well, this game was, it was weird. That's the only thing I can say. The Raiders were in complete control at halftime. They come out for the second half, and I've never seen this happen, but once it happened, I was like, you know, it's kind of weird that that doesn't happen more often. But Derek Carr, second play of the second half, is taking a snap from under center and basically pulled his hand out just a little bit too early, and the ball just caught him perfectly on the pinky. And, you know, they were calling it a dislocated pinky on his right hand, but it looked like more... you know, the feeling you get when you stick your pinky into the spokes of a motorcycle that's going like 60 miles an hour. It
yeah,
looked
who
like
doesn't
that.
Know that feeling. Yeah.
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 Yeah. So it was more mangled than dislocated, but they got it patched up. But on that play, he had lost the fumble. Panthers came right back and you know, got the short field and got the touchdown, and Matt McGloin had to come out for a series, and they went they didn't go three and out, but they went pretty quickly out, and then they have to punt, and then Ted Ginn catches an 88-yard touchdown. The thing turned around so quickly, and all of a sudden the Panthers were in control. And then Carr comes back and leads a late charge for the Raiders. This game, you know, Panthers had no Keekly. They had no Ryan Khalil. They were missing just too many valuable parts in this one, but... you know, when it came down to it, they had a couple of just key mistakes in the fourth quarter. They had a play where A.J. Klein was running down the middle of the field with Michael Crabtree with no safety help. Carr ended up delivering it was a nice pass. It was a big play. And it was just kind of one of those things where it's like, how did that happen? You know, how do you have your backup linebacker running with their borderline Pro Bowl receiver down the middle of the field with no one helping them behind it? They're lucky they didn't give a touchdown.
Yeah, well, and that's something Oakland has done a great job of this year, because my guess is that was Tampa 2 coverage. So the middle linebacker has the high hole, or the middle hole, really. And the Raiders, Bill Musgrave has aligned his receivers consistently each week. He does this. He finds your most prominent zone coverage and aligns his receivers in a way that's going to get you the worst matchup possible for the defense. And in that case, he probably had somebody that occupied the safety with their route, occupied the other safety with their route on the other side. And you can isolate those matchups. It takes good protection to do that too. And that's the other thing people talk about with the Raiders, is their offensive lines played well, and they help their offensive line and pass protection by keeping extra guys in there. So it's a well-coached, well-put-together offense on a lot of fronts.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, look, Raiders are certainly getting it done. They are in control in the AFC West. And one other thing with the Panthers, I mean, look, the Panthers fought today. They did not have what they needed to have to win this game, and they were still right in position to win it. Of all things, Greg Olsen with a big drop, you know, it would have been a tough-ish catch. But it's a catch that you expect Greg Olsen to make 98 times out of 100, and he can't come up with it downfield. That would have put him in position to kick the game-tying field goal. And it was just sort of a microcosm of what's happened to the Panthers this year. They're still fighting hard, but, boy, just things are going wrong at all the worst times. And right now this team is sitting at 4-7 and not really in it anymore. I think we can sort of make that call.
Yeah, and they go on the road to Seattle next week, too. So it's an uphill battle.
Yep. Yeah, Andy, before we move on to topic 4, I just wanted to tell you about something that you already know about, but you can pretend you don't know about, so it feels more spontaneous, but we have a new show.
Yeah, that's
we have
right.
a second show.
Yeah, you and I have a new show. We're going to put that out, what, on Thursday mornings? Is that the plan?
Going to come out Thursdays. So Andy and I are contractually obligated. We made a verbal agreement to talk about football on Wednesdays. It's going to be an Andy heavy show for you Andy fans out there, but it's going to be more of a look forward. It's going to be a little bit shorter than the show we do on Monday mornings. I don't know if we're going to call it 10 things, but we haven't decided.
Well,
we should
have
talked about all
this
before we before we started recording today, Andy. But
it'll be more look-ahead analysis oriented. And if you have ideas for what you want, you and I can discuss, Gary. But anything's in play because it's all look-ahead stuff, which is my favorite stuff to do.
Yeah. So looking ahead, hey, you got any questions? Send them. Get us on Twitter, get us on Facebook, send a talkback at mmqb.com. Wait, talkback at themmqb.com is what the actual email is. So yeah, it's going to be really good, and it will be in your feed on Thursday mornings. We're excited. We're really excited. Just in time for the holiday season. This is our gift to you.
Yeah, and our gift to our families too, to add a workload right now this time of year with the bye weeks disappearing too. It's great. We don't have to see anybody else ever. It's just us and TV screens and podcast headphone sets.
You and I, we got to get some like little shack up in, I don't know, the Yukon or something like that, and we'll just watch football and then record a podcast.
Works for me.
Don't have to have any other human contact. So look out for that in your feeds Thursday, starting this week and through the rest of the season. Hope you enjoy it. Let us know if you do. But for now,
number four,
that is the Baltimore Ravens. They tried a little bit more with the running game today, and it worked out. They end up beating the Bengals. This was a shorthanded Bengals team. They had no AJ Green, no Gio Bernard, and they went into Baltimore, and the Ravens jumped out quickly. This was a game that was Ravens were up 16-3 at halftime, and Bengals made a spirited comeback, but never really closed the gap enough to make a serious challenge here. But the Ravens finally get it going on the ground a little bit more. They've been running the ball well; they just haven't been running it often. And they called for 27 runs today, one of them being reversed to Mike Wallace. But 13 apiece for Dixon and West.
Yeah, and that's a step up. I was so disgusted watching their film, quite frankly, in the Dallas game a few weeks ago. That's the best example. There's no explanation for why they didn't run the ball more. They were killing Dallas, running the ball out of three wide receiver sets, getting a lighter box and just running to the space inside. So they've gotten away from the running game several times this season. It's nice to see that they didn't do that here. They did have a little bit of a lead, so you wonder if that made it easier for Marty Morningwig to drop back, or not drop back, but hand the ball off. I'll believe it when I see it, though. I need to see more of this from Baltimore. They're a team built to, and they don't have a dominant running game, but they don't have the type of passing game that you can hinge your entire offense on. Flacco's been uneven this season. Their receivers are still yet to come together. I thought they'd eventually all find their rhythm within the offense, but that has not happened yet anyway. So they need to run the ball in Baltimore if they're going to continue on the path that they've somehow managed to get on still as the leaders in the AFC North.
Well, not to back it up a week, but do you chart run pass breakdown when you watch film?
I normally don't, but I did for that Dallas game because I knew I could count the run plays quickly. I think they had like two in the second half.
It was 22-2 was the pass run ratio in the second half in a game where you're trying to not get worn down by that Dallas run game and that Dallas offensive line, and they ran it twice. They had first possession in the second half. They possessed the ball for, I think it was just over or just under 10 minutes in the second half. It was crazy.
It was. And we don't mean to talk about something that's a week old, but it's relevant here because they did run the ball in this game, but they've done that a number of times this year too, Gary. They've had other games. The Jets game comes to mind where it was very windy. Even the Jets were running the ball often. That has to be their theme, because the other thing about Baltimore is their defense is tremendous. And maybe they don't run the ball in Baltimore because they think they're running against their own defense. That's the best run defense in the NFL. I would even say by a wide margin at this point. That defensive line with Michael Pierce and Brandon Williams, their D tackles, that's the new Pat Williams and Kevin Williams combo in the NFL right now. It's too bad Michael Pierce isn't named Michael Williams, because then we could call that Williams Wall too. Those two guys are tremendous. Yeah, it's all right. Michael Pierce is fine, and he's a name that deserves to be known. He's an undrafted rookie, and he's played as well as any rookie defensive player in the league this season.
It's exciting. That's a very exciting claim to make, by the way, because who didn't love the Williams Wall?
Yeah, that was.
But
we have
one other thing to talk about from this game. Did you see the last play of this game, Andy?
No, I did not.
All right. Do you remember? Oh, I want to say it was about 3 weeks back, and we talked about the, I believe you said the play call was handcuff, where the 49ers were, end of the first half against the Saints, and so rather, clock was more valuable than the yardage at that point, so the Saints were running a play with about 8 seconds left. 49ers just tackled all of their receivers right at the snap, and that's, they got the holding penalty, but it only moved the ball 5 yards, and the clock ran down to 2 seconds, so they had to just come out and kick the field goal. And it was a thing that other teams had done, but it was not the most sportsmanlike thing that we've seen this season.
No, it's fine. It's totally within the rules. What do you mean sportsmanlike?
So fast forward, well, not quite to where we are today, but the week after that, Greg Bedard over at SI.com, our old friend he's a former MMQB guy, now an SI lead NFL writer over there, he reported that a league source told him the rule going forward would be if that happens more than once, officials have been instructed to call a 15-yard unsportsmanlike conduct penalty for a palpably unfair act. That's according to a league source. And also the time would be put back on the clock. So they're obviously, they recognize this is a problem and they don't want it to get out of hand. This got out of hand on the last play today because there were 11 seconds left. The Ravens had the ball at their own 23. They're protecting a 7-point lead. Nope, I got the math wrong. Yeah, they're protecting a 7-point lead. So they have it at their own 23. They send the punt team out. It is 4th and 8 or whatever. There are 11 seconds left. Sam Cook gets the snap and just sort of hangs out back there because literally the other 10 players all tackled Bengals and are holding on to them, and it's just 10 individual wrestling matches going on.
Oh, they did it. Yeah, they did it on the
offense. So all the flags come out, and Cook just sort of hangs out and eventually walks out of the back of the end zone, and time had expired, and they came out and said the play is a safety, but the game is over. And the final score was 19-14.
So the rule is you can't end a half, first or second half, on a defensive penalty. But if you're the offensive special team side, if you're punting the ball, you're not quite defense yet because you haven't kicked the ball. And so that's an interesting one. They'll have to fix that. And in the NFL, they'll have to – you don't want games ending this way. So they're going to have to come up with something. This is why the rule book gets so big and obnoxious, but it has to, because we have to have answers for this stuff. Yeah. And they'll have to have an answer for that in the NFL. And the one they told Bedard about, where if you do it twice, that's 50, that's not enough. It's because what's going to happen is there's going to be a playoff game. Someone's going to do it once, and that's going to be all it takes. And people are going to say, hey, what the hell? And it's going to ruin the playoff game. So, and that'll apparently that's going to have to happen before they make the rule, because they really shouldn't allow the handcuffs thing. I don't know what exactly the solution would be. Probably the 15 yards and a redo of the downs a good one. But these plays, I like them from a tactical standpoint, but it's not good for fans, viewing audience standpoint.
It was brilliantly fiendish, but it was the ugliest thing I think you could ever imagine. It was literally 10 simultaneous blatant holds going on for, 8 to 10 seconds each.
Impressive.
And that's how that game
ended. 10 guys won a wrestling match.
There you go.
Number 5.
But we'll go on to topic number 5, something a little more beautiful, a little more aesthetically pleasing, and that is the Atlanta Falcons offense. They hang 38 points on Arizona. The Cardinals, for all their problems on the offense side of the ball, they had been playing very well defensively. They got Tyrann Mathieu back today as well, so you figure this might be a sort of a steeper challenge for the Falcons, but they end up racking up 38, a couple of very big plays for Taylor Gabriel on little catch-and-run screen plays that he sort of weaved and looked like a return specialist going for 2 long touchdowns. But I don't know. What do you make of the Falcons' offense going forward? Because this was an offense that didn't look good in their last game in that loss at Philadelphia.
Well, Gabriel's becoming a bigger factor in their offense, and that's been the case now for about the last month. And it's not just in the production, which has been very good, but the way they're using him, the way what they're featuring him on, when they're going to him, he's gradually becoming a bigger piece. And why that's important, we know Atlanta, or maybe we've said it before in the show anyway, Atlanta's forte is operating out of base personnel. They go with two backs or two tight ends on the field, and they make you keep your linebackers on the field. And their playbook is expansive out of that, and they're a great base personnel team. The best in the league, maybe aside from New England with their two tight end sets there in New England. So that's how they beat you. If they have Gabriel playing like this, then now they can also go three wide receiver personnel, which were everybody's playbook becomes expansive, their passing playbook. So if this team gets that dimension with Mohamed Sanu, Gabriel, and of course Julio Jones, this is arguably the most dynamic, explosive offense in the NFC and maybe the NFL potentially. I don't know if they'll produce like that week in and week out, but this is an offense, Gary, that could hang 500 yards on you any given Sunday, as they say.
Yeah, this was a big day for Atlanta, and you know, Cardinals having the same problems sustaining offense. They had all that depth at wide receiver, and they're just not really getting anything out of those guys outside of Larry Fitzgerald. It's tough. This is a lost season for Arizona, or at least on the verge of being a lost season. I guess they're still in the wild card hunt a little bit.
Wow, 4-6. What a fine line it is in the NFL. This is why I love the NFL. Because a lot of times when there's a lost season, it's like something like what happened to Baltimore last year, where guys just kept dropping one by one. They're going to injured reserve, and hey, it happens. That hasn't been the case in Atlanta. Arizona. They've lost Jerron Brown on offense. They've had some injuries on the offensive line, Jared Valdir at left tackle, namely. But that's it. That's pretty standard. What's happened is guys who played well last year have taken everything down a notch. They've been a tick worse, maybe two ticks worse. Carson Palmer has not thrown well at the deep intermediate levels, which is what this whole system's predicated on. Receivers aren't winning one-on-one. It's not just Michael Floyd who's had a bad year. Other guys, John Brown hasn't been the same. Mm-hmm. J.J. Nelson hasn't quite been the same. And so Fitzgerald and David Johnson are having nice seasons, but everybody else has played just a little bit worse in Arizona, and that's all it's taken to move this team from top of the NFC to lower middle half of the NFC.
And you know what else, Andy? Some special teams mishaps.
Yep, those count too. You think I don't like special teams. It's not that. I was elated with the special teams in the Sunday night game tonight, Denver-Kansas City. I watched some of that stuff. I don't refute the value of special teams. I just don't analyze it because I don't have time to watch it on film, and I don't know anybody who does other than special teams coaches.
There you go. We'll have to get a special teams intern on the show to break it all down for us.
I would appreciate that, actually.
Our Jay Feely.
Yeah, he does a good job, too, by the way.
He does do a good job.
Yeah.
Well, let's go on.
Number 6.
We have the Miami Dolphins pulling out a unexpectedly wild one against the 49ers. They sort of hung on at the end. This was a day when Jay Ajayi did not get going the way he has been the last 5 or 6 weeks or so. And the Dolphins are banged up. They're banged up front. Tunsil had to slide over to left tackle with Brandon Albert out, and Tunsil is playing injured himself. Mike Pouncey was out in this game. They weren't quite able to do what they have been doing. The run game was limited to, let's see, the totals ended up being 26 carries, 95 yards, and that included Tannehill, 6 for 34. So this was not a good day for the run game. However, it was a very good day for Ryan Tannehill, who ends up throwing for 285, 3 touchdowns, and they play turnover-free ball and eventually hang on 31-24 against the Niners, who fall short in the end. But I guess my question for you was, this Dolphins offense has been fascinating all year, the way they have sort of changed gears and become something that no one really expected them to become. Do they need Ryan Tannehill? Well, they need Ryan Tannehill short term. Is Ryan Tannehill a guy who you would plug in this offense long term? Should they make a commitment to him? Or is this a team that can kind of plug in, a kind of okay guy and they can get by with what they try and do?
That's a tough question. I would keep Tannehill there, I think, because the risk of plugging in a kind of okay guy, you know, I get what you're doing there. Tannehill last week made a number of big time plays down the stretch of that game when they came back and beat the Rams in the final 6 minutes. He destroyed their zone coverages, and it wasn't just dinking and dunking. He made tight window. Yeah. On a rope type of throws, and he can do that. He has that ability. He can also make throws on the move at times. Now, he's inconsistent. That can work against you as well. But the inconsistency's abated every week, it feels like, there in Miami with him. He's getting more and more consistent, I guess you'd say. And that's what happens with Adam Gase's quarterbacks a lot of the times. He's very good, Gase is, at adjusting to what the quarterbacks do well, working with them, putting them on the appropriate type of leash through his play designs and play calling. So I think Tannehill's progressing in this offense, and the fact that they're able to win today, and you mentioned Tunsil actually wound up not playing in this one. So they had Sam Young at left tackle, Craig Urbick at left guard, and Steen at center. And those were the guys they finished with last week as well. And they've come out successful twice with those guys. That's a big win for this team, because they do want to run the ball, and you can't do that the same way if you have your backup offensive lineman in. And yet here they are finding ways to win against, you know, not great teams, but NFL teams that'll beat you if you're not 100% a lot of the time.
Yeah. And look, if the season ended right now, which it won't, but if it did, Miami Dolphins are in the playoffs. Denver Broncos are not. Dolphins would be going to they'd be going to
Baltimore. We don't have to put the specific
Baltimore
game out there, do we?
The Saturday night game? The season just ended.
All right, is that the Saturday night wild card game, or is that the Sunday early afternoon wild card game that they'd be playing Baltimore in this postseason setup
I would think that would be the Saturday afternoon slot.
That's probably the lowest marquee one. The defense is getting better too in Miami. I know we're going to move on, but that just suffice to say, and San Francisco's not an offense that'll challenge you in that way. They're playing better there, but it's not a great offense, of course. But that Dolphins defense is getting better each week. Their defensive tackles are right up there with Baltimore's, in fact.
Yeah. Now look, in the end, it was a, you know, Colin Kaepernick sort of improvised a pretty nice comeback here, and they came up just a little bit short. So ended up being a good game, entertaining game, not necessarily well played, but entertaining.
Number 7.
But let's go on to topic number 7, and that is the Tennessee Titans hanging on against the Bears. And this was one you had your eye on, Andy, I know, and I guess we'll start with the Titans, and you know, it was an interesting matchup against a Bears defense that is sort of, I don't know, overlooked and underappreciated at this point.
It's a good Bears defense. It really is. That young secondary has overachieved, which is the second year in a row that their defensive backs have overachieved, in fact. Their pass rush, when Leonard Floyd's healthy — he's not right now, but when he's been healthy, that pass rush has been dynamic off the edges. And I like their interior run defenders. I like Eddie Goldman. I like Akeem Hicks. So and they have linebackers who can run. It's unfortunate that Freeman's suspended right now, but it's really unfortunate that it sounds like Danny Trevathan suffered a pretty bad knee injury. So maybe things will change at that position. But the Bears' defense is one of the – it's in the upper half of the NFL statistically, and they look that way on film. Their offense has problems, and with Cutler out, of course, that's a big deal, but their receivers haven't made plays this season, and that was really highlighted in this game. That's what lost the game for them. In fact, if the receivers had made even 50% more of just NFL caliber plays, basic NFL catches by that high standard, they would have won this game. Tennessee's an interesting team, though, aren't they, Gary? I mean, if I told you they're the second highest scoring team in the league since week 5, how your jaw hits the floor, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, look, we were talking, you know, a month and a half ago about what's wrong with this team, and why don't they open it up a little bit for Mariota, and, you know, what's going to happen? What will become of them going forward?
And what has happened is, they've evolved. So we weren't wrong about them early in the year.
Yeah.
They were very one-dimensional. They were a heavy running team, and they're still that. They're an attitude team, but you can't be only that in today's NFL. And I wonder, they've been by far the best team in two-minute situations this season as well. It seems like every week they've had a two-minute hurry-up offense, and at the end, especially of the first half, Mariota takes them down the field and they score significant points. I wonder if that helped push the offense further, because they go to their spread formations when they do that. They're a whole different offense. They're not going to be running out of two tight end sets or two running back sets. They go three wide and spread you out, and they were so good at that. I think their passing game, I wonder if Mularkey saw that and said, hey, let's expand this passing game a little bit, because it's a much more diverse offense. They're as diverse, in fact, as probably any team in the NFL right now.
Yeah. And look, yeah, that Bears receiving core, that was a bummer. That Josh Bellamy drop. The Josh Bellamy drop in the end zone, and then they pulled him. It was very sad to see.
It was so sickening. I felt like Josh Bellamy just watching it. Like, I could feel 1% of his pain, which is more than I cared to feel. It was unless you're a fan of the Titans, you probably don't want to see that. It's just an unfortunate drop.
And then Deontay Thompson dropped that ball, sliding it back in the end zone. That's a very catchable ball on fourth down there.
And Cameron Meredith had a bunch of drops. It was a bad game for those wide receivers. And last thing on the Titans, I guess, kind of related to the Bears, if you're dropping passes and we're criticizing you, it also means you were getting open. And Tennessee's pass defense is vulnerable. They're not good at the cornerback position. Parrish Cox has been a problem at times. That continued in this game.
Yeah.
And their pass rush isn't good, Gary. They do a lot of stunts and twists out of their five-man blitz concepts, the Dick LeBeau stuff, and they're pretty good at that, but just lining up and rushing four on you, which is what they did in this one because they were up by so many points late in the game, they were not effective here, and they really should have been. It's an inexperienced Bears passing offense. They've got some backups along that offensive line in Chicago, and Tennessee's pass rush disappeared, and that's very concerning for this team moving forward.
Yeah, Parrish Cox has been a...
He's had a bad one, a tough year. He does just enough good stuff that right when you get to the point of, I'm sure they're at the point of benching him every week, he does something just good enough that you say, oh, well, there's Parrish Cox. There's the guy we signed. Yeah.
as bad as he's been this year, the play that still sticks out to me was him getting trucked by Matthew Stafford in, like, I was like week two or three at this point. Yeah. But every time I see the guy, that's all I can think of is Matthew Stafford steamrolling him.
Well, teams were taking deep shots at him early in the game, earlier this season, just to just test the waters early. Let's see if we can get him to back off as well. They're now doing that to Jason McCourty. Each of the last 2 weeks, he's had a 33-yard pass interference on the first drive of a game. So Chicago saw Indianapolis get McCourty with that. They went right after him, I believe it was the first snap of this game, and they beat him. So they've got issues, and McCourty hurt his knee, so he didn't play at the end of this one. They've got issues at both cornerback spots, though, right now.
Yeah. Now, it's look, that AFC South is imminently winnable. But, I guess you could do it with a flawed defense. Probably can't win a playoff game with it, though.
Number 8.
And, Andy, let's go on to topic 8 and open the mailbag. So I'm actually going to say this at the top. Usually I forget to say it, or I say it at the end, or sometimes I just say it quietly to myself and no one can hear it. But if you want to send a question to the MMQB 10 Things podcast mailbag, you can tweet Andy_Benoit or GGrambling_SI. If you use the hashtag MMQB podcast mail, it is more likely to be seen. Andy and I are both on Facebook. You can get us there. Or if you really want to, you can send something to talkback@themmqb.com. No, that is the least likely to make it through. But let's open it. Let's see what we got this week. We're going to start with Josh Mays at Josh_Mays. Is the slow progression of reads for Dak Prescott any different than other rookie QBs, e.g. Ben Roethlisberger, Derek Carr, RG3, and that also comes with the hashtag huge in Australia, which we officially are. I haven't seen any metrics, but if there is a hashtag, it is true. We are huge in Australia, so congratulations to the both of us, Andy.
Yeah,
but yeah, I'd be curious about that too. We've talked about, or I shouldn't say we, you have pointed out that Dak is a little bit slow to get through his reads. Is that a common problem for rookie quarterbacks?
Oh, yeah, sure, absolutely. And especially the type of issue he has, which, and it's not a glare. Look, that offensive line nullifies most of this, so it's not a glaring issue. But if we're critically breaking down Dak Prescott, which we should of any NFL player, and especially one who's becoming so spotlighted like he is, then it's something worth talking about. When his first read is covered, he doesn't transition well off of that first read into the second. It's almost like he restarts the progressions in his head. He doesn't naturally go from read number one to read number two. It's read number one. That's not there. Okay, now let me go find read number two. So he'll get better at that, but that's a normal type of thing for young QBs. It's an experience factor as much as anything. I'd hope he does get better, though, because they're not running a very complex offense there for him. They don't have to. They have better players than everybody else. So he should show progression, no pun intended. He should show progression in this department over the last couple weeks of the season.
Yeah. No, that's a good answer, Andy. I learned something there, and that is, when I saw that question, that was something I was curious about. This next one comes from Equal Opportunity Hater at Not One To Be PC. That's a lot of wordplay on that hashtag right there, or Twitter handle right there.
What's this question going to be?
Well, it's a pretty legitimate question here. It's will the Bears be making wholesale changes in the offseason? My guess would be no.
We can answer that quickly. Yeah.
Yeah, they kind of put everything in place for this year, and they had a breakdown with the injuries on defense. They also, their offensive line early in the year, you had Josh Sitton coming in at the last minute. You had Kyle Long was clearly playing hurt in the first couple of games, and you had at center Cody Whitehair, who was playing left tackle at Kansas State this time last year, and interior line was a problem early on, and it just they needed a couple weeks to get this thing together, and then when it started to get together, the defense fell apart and they lost their quarterback, and it just didn't work out this year. But I don't think there's a roster that needs to be blown up.
Well, and they already did make the wholesale changes on defense, because I believe they've changed 10 starting positions since it's either last year or the year before. I think it's since last year. So
now we talk about including the nickel corner, 11 new starters of the 12 spots
so
over the last 18 months.
Yeah, so we're asking about the offense, and really what we're asking is, do they need to replace Jay Cutler or not? My guess is they won't do that because the pieces you talked about, the other ones that they have in place, I think this team's a lot closer to being where they want to be, and at least on the track they want to be on. They're a lot closer than their record indicates.
Yeah. And look, people seem to, they just can't wait to get rid of Jay Cutler out there, is the sense. I don't know if that's Bears fans or just, sort of the national folks sort of projecting onto Bears fans, but yeah, I don't know. I don't think Jay Cutler is going anywhere. I think they'll bring in a developmental guy because I think it's a mistake to have not done that the last couple of years, but yeah, I think Cutler's their starting quarterback next year.
He's like that buddy you have that you think, I'm not going to be his friend anymore. I can't deal with this. He's not reliable. And then you go out, you bump into him on a Saturday night downtown, and you just have enough of a blast once in a while that you keep him in the loop. You can't get rid of the guy. I like him as a player, by the way.
Yeah, I do too. Look, I said early this year when everyone was cheerleading for Brian Hoyer, I thought it was absurd. But the other thing is Cutler, yes, you can get out of the contract now, but you're not paying him very much. He doesn't make very much for a starting quarterback in the NFL. He makes, his base is 12.5 next year. That's a very good deal. That's a very friendly deal. That's a placeholder deal if you want him to be a placeholder.
Yep. So they're in a good spot, because if they do get rid of him, it likely means they found a rookie that they just fell in love with and drafted.
Yeah. So there you go. You're going to see the same Bears roster next year in all likelihood. Very similar, at least. Next question is coming from... so this is from friend of the show, Jocelyn from Sonoma, who had many questions, but we're only going to take one for now, and maybe we'll address some of the other ones later. But her question was, why does the media focus so much on yardage stats and no other metrics when evaluating teams? her point, Jocelyn, to shorten it and to paraphrase you here, but her point is, you know, especially early in the season, strength of schedule does not really factor into it. So you get a team like the Packers who are ranked number one against the run, even though they really haven't played anyone with a very good running game and that sort of thing. So yeah. I would actually boil this question down to you, Andy, as this. When you're breaking down film, how much do you factor in strength of the opponent?
Not very much, because when you break down film, what you learn is kind of like what we talked about with Arizona Cardinals earlier. The difference between the good teams and the bad teams is razor thin. It really is in the NFL. The parity thing is true, and it's not just parity from team to team. It's from player to player, or at least let's say position group to position group. One team's wide receiving group is not that much worse or better than the next team's in more cases than not. So I don't look at that stuff a lot. I thought Green Bay's run defense, to use that example, they were legitimately great early in the season. They weren't as great as all-time status, which is what the numbers said, so I get Jocelyn's point. But that's my beef with statistics altogether, is that there's so many situations in football, and it's so different. In basketball, you go back and forth, and the situation's pretty much still the same. There's not a lot of space. There's two-pointers or three-pointers, and you're playing a fluid game. Baseball's an isolated game of pitcher versus batter again and again. Football, it's so much about field position. There's 22 moving pieces on there. Clock's a bigger factor a lot of the times. There's play clocks and game clocks. Clocks to account for, different groupings of guys. It's just so many variables that statistics, there's no way they can ever really reflect things as accurately as we're going to want them to.
Yeah. And look, they're a good snapshot. And, you know, sort of going a little bit deeper into this, I've always been a very big fan of Pro Football Focus. I follow their stuff. I read their stuff. I do think they're, when you just, the numbers they brand players with, I think gets a little too much weight. And you know,
I agree. I think they do good work there. I think it's a great concept. I think they have better stats than a lot of people, but the grading stuff, to me, that doesn't work. That's because grades are inherently black and white, and the more you watch film, the more gray you see every time. And the more I learn about football and the more I talk to coaches, the more gray I realize there is. So that's the problem with stats and the film. They don't correlate because one is gray and the other is black and white, and those are actually opposites, even though they don't seem like it.
I always say, you know, with the PFF grades, I always say it's almost like, you know, you're a month into the baseball season, you're looking at the batting average leaders. If you have a good batting average, chances are you're good and you're better than someone with a batting average. But, you know, there are a lot of variables that play into it, especially when you're talking about such a small sample size. And, you know, especially, you know, there's stuff like if you face the Giants last year and your two cornerbacks, one's going to cover Odell Beckham, the other was going to cover Reuben Randall. The guy with the Beckham assignment is probably going to end up with a lower grade than the Randall assignment. That doesn't mean he's the worst player. He's probably the better player if he's being asked to cover the superstar receiver instead of the sled on the other side.
Right, and he's also getting different safety help, and he's seeing different routes, and it's a whole, you can't compare it. There are no apples anywhere in any of this stuff.
I believe I would sum it up by saying it's all a rich tapestry.
All right. It's a nice artful way to say it, and that's a good way to wrap up a question from someone who lives in Sonoma too. She'll probably appreciate that.
I didn't even think of that angle. That's fantastic.
Number nine.
Well, with that, let's hit topping nine, the lightning-ish round. Let's start with the Saints in New Orleans. Rams come in. This was sort of Bounty Gate Bowl. Sean Payton versus Greg Williams. I don't know what the relationship is now, but I'm guessing not too friendly after that whole thing went down. But this was, the Saints just ran it up. And this game included, when the game was out of hand, Willie Snead on a trick play connecting with Tim Hightower on a 50-yard touchdown pass. That's the kind of day it was. But the Saints are really rolling right now.
Yeah, they are rolling, and Sean Payton, by the way, has a history of running up the score on guys he doesn't like. So I would guess that he doesn't have fond thoughts for Greg Williams. That's just a guess, though. It's too bad that we're talking about the Rams like this, because their defense has actually played very well over the bulk of the season, both in man coverage and zone coverage. They do a lot of stuff. Today was a bad day for them. The other thing that happens is Jared Goff had a productive day. My guess is it's going to look a lot different on film than his first game did, where the offense was significantly watered down for him. So we're not talking about that, though, because they still got blown out. So, yeah, good game by the Saints. An unfortunate game for the Rams, though. Gary, did you get any of the Jaguars-Bills games on one of your 10,000 TVs that you watch this stuff on?
It was on TV 17.
Okay, TV 17 is good enough. So Jacksonville falls now to 2-9, and we've talked about Gus Bradley before. He's done after this year. Would you agree?
Yeah, I mean, I don't see how it can be any other way. I think the question now is what do they do with Blake Bortles, and can they salvage the guy? But yeah, Gus Bradley, and look, it didn't work out, and I'd be curious to see Gus Bradley. I hope he'd get another chance down the line, maybe 4 or 5 years from now, and this is not the end of his chance as a head coach, but yeah, it probably is for now.
Yep.
Giants and Browns. And this one, I am really curious to talk to you on Wednesday, Andy, when we record our second show, our new second show that is coming out on Thursdays. Because Odell Beckham Jr., a little more creative with his use today. And that's sort of been a complaint of mine. And I know that's been a thought of yours as the year has gone on. And one reason I really realize it today, it's like all season, my daughter will sit in front of the TV with me when a Giants game is on, and she loves Odell Beckham Jr. because she loves saying the name, and that's about it. And she will ask on every offensive play before it starts, where's Odell Beckham Jr.? And I will repeatedly say, bottom of the screen, bottom of the screen. Yeah, that's him on the bottom of the screen again. He's right there on the bottom of the screen, and it'll be the same thing over and over again. Today was the first time where it was like, yeah, he's inside. He's motioning. He's going to the other side. You see those three receivers at the top. He's actually the middle guy there. Oh, now he's moving inside. And yeah, they did some cool stuff with him, and he ended up having a big day. He caught a touchdown where they ended up getting him isolated on a linebacker in the red zone. And it was kind of like, you know, that's what you should be doing with that guy.
Your daughter has a very good football mind, too, because that question, where is Odell Beckham Jr., that's the first one I'm sure that enters the defensive coordinator's mind who play against him, and the safeties and linebackers and corners and anybody else that's ever had to step on a field with Odell Beckham. So they have started moving him around a little more lately, and it's not just him, it's everybody, because they have three guys who are very similar at that position stylistically, and Shepard, who's kind of the inside guy predominantly, and Cruz and Beckham. They've done a good job with them lately. And the other thing I've noticed, especially in that Bears game 2 weeks ago, is they have exploited dedicated double teams against Beckham. So when the defense is clearly playing two guys on him, not just where they're playing rolled coverage over the top, but where they have two guys zeroing in on Beckham, they've done a good job of building routes off of that to make the defense pay for that. The Texans hosted the Chargers in this one, and the Chargers, Gary, you declared them the best team in the AFC West a few weeks ago. Do you still feel that way after this victory for them?
I think you could maybe make the argument. I think the Raiders, if you ask me, I would say the Raiders are the best team in the AFC West, and the numbers, especially the win column, would back that up. But, yeah, I think the Chargers are right there. I think, neutral field, they're right there with the Chiefs and the Broncos.
Yeah, they're a hard team to play against. They're very well coached. They've had some injuries on defense, of course. But that is a hard offense to play against. And the Texans found that out. Not a lot of teams have been able to be productive against Houston's – really, it's their secondary mixed with their pass rush that's done so well this season. But San Diego's extremely well coached in the passing game and well executed, too. They're coached and executed by Phillip Rivers on the field.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And we will wrap up the lightning round with another boring Tom Brady fourth quarter last minute comeback. It's so ho hum. This one was really interesting in East Rutherford. And look, they always have interesting games with the Jets, it seems like. And, you know, it was the same thing when the Jets knocked him off last December. Gronkowski got hurt in this game. He did not play most of it. He I guess, suffered some sort of back injury. It was all very unclear. If you can believe it, the Patriots were not terribly forthcoming with information about the injury during this game. So they end up, they're down 10-0, and then they sort of shut the Jets down, and they come back. And Brady to Malcolm Mitchell. Two more touchdowns for Malcolm Mitchell, who is a favorite of mine in this one. But I did want to bring up one thing, Andy, and it's not terribly consequential to this game, but it did cost the Patriots some points, and that is their clock management. I'm starting to question it, and I know Bill Belichick is the delicate genius, and I don't want to, I hate to upset the delicate genius, but they got down to the end of the first half, had a 14-yard gain with about, 28 seconds to go or so, and they decided to hold on to their last timeout, and then they ended up throwing an incomplete pass, and then they only had time for a field goal. So they ended up going into the half with a timeout, but they also decided so late that they'd run out and take the field goal that they rushed it. Gostkowski missed it. So, your kicker should still probably make that 39-yarder, but we saw in the Seahawks game a couple weeks ago that they lost. Brady said that thing about on that sneak that seemed like the sneak to nowhere where he wasn't really trying to score. He kind of said, well, I wasn't trying to score. We didn't want to leave too much time. And then, of course, they didn't score and they lost the game anyway. And you can go back to Super Bowl 49 where they didn't spend the timeouts and had the Seahawks just run the ball and scored a touchdown. No time for Brady because they just held on to those timeouts. And I wonder about their clock management. That was a very long question I just asked you.
Yeah, speaking of clock management, we're in the lightning round here.
And, seriously.
And we're doing our best lightning round of the year in terms of efficiency, and then Gary Gramling screeches it to a halt to rip Bill Belichick's clock management skills. But actually, I don't disagree with you. I hear what you're saying. And I have some of my fact checkers. Cal Kleiman's the one who comes to mind. He's a very... Yeah. Thorough nerdy numbers guy, and he sent me a long rambling email earlier this year about all of these Belichick clock management gripes that he raised that are similar to yours. And there are people that have had their eyebrows raised before with Belichick. He sees things a little differently. That doesn't mean he's always seeing it correctly, or it doesn't mean he's always a genius either.
Yeah.
Sometimes
I know that was
it
difficult.
Does so too. It worked out in that. I thought the one in the Super Bowl was one of the all-time bad decisions at the time, and I thought
unreal.
That for several weeks after that, where they we're talking about the Malcolm Butler interception play, of course, and not using your timeout before that. And I still don't think it was a great one, but Belichick, his reasoning turned out right. He saw chaos on Seattle's sideline. He claims we see you can see him on NFL films looking across the way and analyzing their sideline. And he made an unconventional decision, and it happened to work out really, really well for him there too. So it's, I'd rather just be wrong and not criticize Bill Belichick than go out on that limb, to be honest with you.
That's just because you guys are so close since you did that Gronk story.
he was a great interview. He has his reputation as being surly, but he was anything but that. When the topic's football, he's as good as anyone.
I was squeezed out of that fun, I guess. But that's it. That wraps up the lightning round, that very lightning-ish topic.
Number 10.
We are on to topic number 10. This is the weekly awards. We will start it off, Offensive Player of the Week. Andy, you can go first.
For my offensive player of the week, I'm going to go Marcus Mariota. The way he orchestrates what we talked about as a more flexible, dimensional offense there in Tennessee, he made some plays with his legs in this game against Chicago, and he was very accurate on deep balls. And why that's important is because Tennessee has established a very good first down deep shot passing game. And when you're a running team, deep shots on first downs are critical. You have an advantage there because your play action often impacts the safeties instead of the linebackers out of running formations. It's slower play action. So you can take those deep shots. Mariota's gotten very good on his deep ball.
Yeah. Yeah. My offensive player of the week is Henry Burris of the Ottawa. They'll always be the Rough Riders to me. Not those Rough Riders, but the other Rough Riders.
That is
Henry Burris of the Ottawa Red Blacks, Grey Cup champions. Ends a 40-year drought for Ottawa.
No,
41
are you
years
really
old.
Doing CFL? Are you doing? I went to Canada on Labor Day right before the season, my little preseason vacation thing.
Yep.
And even the Canadians said we don't like our football up here.
Oh, they're all wrong. This game
they
was
said,
incredible.
They said,
okay,
we have
let me set
here,
this up for
bad.
You really quick, Andy. This is going to be the longest Offensive Player of the Week award ever. But let me set this up for you. So Henry Burris, he's 41 years old. You might remember him. You're probably too young for him.
No, I remember him.
Played for the Bears. He was on the Packers for a little bit. But he goes out for pregame warmups and injures his knee during warmups. Now, they're already 10-point underdogs. And he goes out there, and they controlled this game until the end. The Stampeders, they were 10-point favorites. They ended up scoring a touchdown and getting an onside kick and going down. They were on the 2, but couldn't punch it in. Ended up kicking the field goal to tie it at the end of the game. And they, you know, they do the college style overtime in CFL. And Burris found it was Ernest Jackson on the touchdown, on the juggling touchdown, in which he almost went headlong into the Tim Hortons goalpost at the front of the end zone. So Burris ends up throwing the game winner. They stop Bo Levi Mitchell and the Stampeders on the next drive, and that was it. Burris threw for 461 and 3 touchdowns, ran for 2 others. And there you go. He is my Offensive Player of the Week. And by the way, his only NFL start was for the Dick Geron Bears back in 2002, Week 17, because Jim Miller and Chris Chandler were hurt. They lost Week 17 to the eventual Super Bowl champion Tampa Bay Bucks, 15-0. Martin Gramatica, 5 field goals, all the scoring in that one. He would have been our Special Teams Player of the Week.
All right. For my Defensive Player of the Week, I'm going with a couple of NFL players. And you can take your pick. Anyone who saw the game, they don't need an explanation. Von Miller, Justin Houston, I don't care who you take.
Yeah, I was going to say Houston just because it was neat to see him back at full strength and sort of dominating a game like he used to. And I think we've given it to Miller a bunch of times before.
Okay.
So I'll give mine to Justin Houston. You can give yours to Von Miller, and then we'll call it even.
Okay, that works for me. My Special Teams Player of the Week, I'm going to go Justin Tucker, 3 of 3 on field goals of 50-plus yards. I believe he hasn't missed on the season, Gary.
Yeah. He's always – did I tell you that?
No, I read that today.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure.
Taking the special teams one seriously. There's a lot of good special teams. We could do Tyreek Hill.
I was going to say, I was waiting for some sort of punchline, and it just didn't come.
Nope. No, it's not. Yeah, that was the curveball. I actually
very
was
nice.
Hoping
no, Justin
all
Tucker,
day.
Hey, Justin Tucker, if the Ravens had like a league average kicker, I feel like they'd be like 4-7. With Justin Tucker, they're 6-5. Good for them. I was going to give it to Tucker, but I'll give it to Tyreek Hill
for that. See, I only did Tucker because I was hoping, I thought, when I read the article, I thought, oh, Gary's going to do Justin Tucker for special teams. So I had it in my mind all day, I'm going to steal his special teams and leave him scrambling. And then I saw the Chiefs-Broncos game where every special teamer in the game made a dynamic play, and now we have a bunch of guys to choose from. But I'm glad to hear that you did plan Tucker, and I caught you off guard there. We scrambled.
No, I'm
You were not prepared.
No, I especially would have taken Tucker if I knew he was going to be your genuine Special Teams Player of the Week. I feel like that's the greatest honor he could possibly get.
Yeah.
So why double that? But yeah, I'll give it to Hill for that that safety punt. That was pretty awesome when he high-fived D'Anthony Thomas on the way in. The Broncos should trade for D'Anthony Thomas so they can have someone to run down Tyreek Hill next time.
Well, and D'Anthony Thomas used to be Tyreek Hill for them, and Tyreek Hill has just been so good that D'Anthony Thomas has been wedged out. He's still somebody ought to trade for him because he can still do a lot of things Hill does. Tyreek Hill's a difference maker, though, and we see it not just on special teams. He's becoming a much bigger part of their offense, both in how they use him and how they threaten to use him.
Yep. Who you got for Coach of the Week, Andy?
For my Coach of the Week, I think I'll go with I think I do go with Andy Reid because, and it's not just him, it's Nagy, the quarterback coach and offensive coordinator, and the co-offensive coordinator, Brad Childress. They do such a good job with their designs, and their designs won out tonight against a dominant, dynamic Broncos defense.
Yeah. I'm going to give it to Sean Payton just because, I mean, it was ice cold. 555 yards of offense. And like you said, this Rams defense is a good defense. And they, Saints just did literally whatever they wanted, including that trick play at the end to sort of put an exclamation point on it.
That's Sean Payton for you. He will do that. He doesn't care.
Yeah. We do care, and that is the end of our show. Again, second show starring this week, going to be coming out Thursday. Look out for it. But as for now, we would like to thank our sponsor, Mack Weldon. We quite honestly wouldn't be allowed to do either of our shows without their support. So please support the folks at Mack Weldon the way they support us. Thanks to our researcher, Jeff Irwin, and as always to the folks at Digital Media who make us sound so good. And thank you for listening to this episode of the MMQB 10 Things podcast. Honestly, you guys are the best. Andy and I always want to hear from you. Send mailbag stuff. Just write and say hi. Andy_Benoit or ggramling_si. We are also on Facebook. You can get us there. We honestly do love hearing from you. Remember to listen and subscribe to new and archive episodes of the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer, the MMQB podcast with Peter King, and this podcast, the MMQB 10 Things podcast, wherever you listen to podcasts, including the MMQB.com, SI.com, iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and other podcast providers. We will see you guys next week.
This has been a Digital Media production. Find your voice.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.